The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. Well, I remember from my days on the Hill, the last panel was always selected by virtue of press interest. That is to say, the panel in which the press would not be interested because they all had filing deadlines before the last panel. In this case, Dan assures me that it's more like the approach to getting children to eat their vegetables, that the dessert is last. Now, I wasn't sure whether he was referring to this panel being as savory as we will be, or the reception following. But in either case, we're delighted to see you here this afternoon and to discuss the subject of the Obama administration, a preliminary assessment. We're going to look at life from both sides now, actually three different perspectives, but all, as you might guess, from outside the administration, at least so far. No one's yet shared with me their plans. I'm going to just very briefly mention the speakers because you have quite fulsome biographies in the materials that each of you has. We're going to start with Mike Isikoff, formerly of the Washington Post, now Newsweek, an active and aggressive reporter who seems to be quite successful in his trade even without having to revert to making freedom of information requests. But he does understand how government works. He does follow this area and will be giving us what is probably the usual media critical assessment of the Obama administration's first less than 2 months. David Sobel, who's now with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You were one of the founders, I think, actually, of that. Private. Well, in any event. Yes, that's right, electronic privacy. Well, in any event, David is, as I think you all know, he's a recipient of many awards and recognitions for his work on information and privacy, and one of the important litigators for public interest lawsuits that have been opening the doors of government, the files of government, the computers of government, for that matter. And he's going to give us a perspective that is colored by his experience in the courtroom, both recently and not as recent, but also talk about his view of the first 55 days, I guess. And we'll end with Tom Blanton, as someone the other day said, who deserves no introduction. Is that who needs no introduction?
Got a need to know around here.
Right. Tom heads the National Security Archives. He's a prolific writer, speaker, consultant, Freedom of Information Act request maker, and has done a really historic work in collecting government information and making it public through volumes, web presence, and also sponsoring a number of lawsuits through time. And he's going to have sort of he's going to give us the tests that we need to use. We'll take notes going forward, the sort of 10 questions we need to answer before we're ready to assess the success of the Obama administration. We'll be looking at the good, the bad, and I guess the challenges to come. We all have heard so far today about a lot of the good things, the presidential executive order on presidential records, the memorandum to agencies calling for an attorney general's memorandum, calling for an open government directive, and immediately setting a tone on day one of the administration. And also, I think, is the president's perspective and order that first day relating to lobbyists and revolving door and conflicts of interest is related to the transparency issue, because nothing thrives quite like the back room whispering of lobbyists that never make it into the public arena. We all know that from, among other things, the Cheney task force on energy. I guess we really need to withhold judgment on the bad, though there have been some reports in litigation of the Justice Department taking positions that did not advance the cause of open government, but it may be too soon to tell on some of that, state secrets, the absence of any early comment or commitment on the classification system, the absence of any reference to whistleblowers or the Office of Government Information Services, or the tremendous backlog that exists in both pending requests and the handling of lawsuits. And so these are some of the things that we will explore, and then at the end have plenty of time for your questions. So we'll start with Michael. You can either stay down or come up. Your pleasure. You want to use the
stand up.
I don't want to make this
too formal. But anyway, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It is actually not true, as Tom suggested, that I don't use the Freedom of Information Act. I use it quite frequently and have boxes filled with Freedom of Information Act responses that are almost invariably completely useless to my reporting. So they rarely show up, because the stuff that I really want, I usually don't get, and the stuff that I don't want, I get in spades, which makes it hard to keep my office in any kind of order. But that said, it is clearly a useful tool, and every once in a while it does produce the nugget that you're looking for, or something that can inform the nugget that you're writing about. My thoughts on the topic, as I was coming here today, I ran into a neighbor, asked me where I was going, said I was going to be on a panel evaluating how the Obama administration was record was on secrecy, and his reaction was, my God, they've been in office 7 weeks. Don't they get a little longer before you have to start giving them a grade? Fair enough. But that said, there are some interesting observations which I think I could pass along as a sort of daily reporter covering these guys, and, you know, having been banging up my head against the wall for 8 years during the Bush era trying to get information, usually being able to write some good stories about all the information they were not releasing, I can give you a little perspective on what it's like in the new Obama era. And my perspective is this. Look, we got some, you know, great grand pronouncements in the first week, the transparency order, particularly relevant here, suggestions that things were going to change, sort of broad commitments to doing things differently. That's great from a public information perspective. And then you get down into the nitty-gritty, and where are you? And my own perspective is we've seen a few things come out, actually not quite as much as one would have expected, as somebody who was covering, for instance, extensively in recent years, the war on terror, detainee treatment and interrogation issues, allegations of torture, the whole swirl of controversies that surrounded the Bush era. Very quickly, there was a, we were told they were going to move to release the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel memos, which, as you all know, have been sought for years by members of Congress, by the congressional committees, the memos that authorized waterboarding and warrantless surveillance and all the controversial policies of the Bush era. And just 2 weeks ago, we got the first batch. And it actually produced some pretty interesting stuff. There was the John Yoo memo on the Fourth Amendment, just basically saying in October of 2001, we don't have to worry about that anymore. We're now in a state of war, a state of armed conflict. The president is not bound by those constitutional amendments that apply to law enforcement. This is the military, and since the battlefield is everywhere, the military can conduct operations in the United States, surround apartment buildings, seize suspects, set up roadblocks, do whatever it wants without concern about Fourth Amendment restrictions. Oh, and by the way, the First Amendment doesn't really apply either in wartime, so we could take some liberties with that. That was pretty damn interesting and not something we've seen before. But I should point out that these were not, that and some of the others that were released, were not the ones that have been the most contentious and the most sought by Congress. They were memos that actually had been cleared for release towards the latter days of the Bush era. Had been that one in particular, the one that got the headlines, had actually been seen by the House Judiciary Committee. They were allowed to take notes. They weren't able to take a copy of it. And it was unclassified. So it was of the stack of really interesting memos sitting in Tom's old office at the Office of Legal Counsel, not the I wouldn't put it in the inner crown jewels of memos that that we've been looking for. And I mentioned the classification issue, and I'll come back to that in a second because I think that's huge. All the classified OLC memos have yet to be released. Now, again, it's only 7 weeks. But when I've pressed, I said, this is great. When do we see the really good stuff? You kind of get sloughed off and say, well, we're working on it. There's a review. We'll see. No commitment to releasing the ones that have been most sought. And I should point out that it really isn't that hard to release material from the government that's embarrassing to the last administration. The real test of openness of an administration is when you're willing to release material that might not let you look good. And there we're a long way off from seeing how the Obama people are going to handle that one. Although I can give you an example, right, in that that's sort of in that sphere, where while they're releasing the OLC memos, there was also right after the executive order on Guantanamo shutting down, the Pentagon let on that there was a Defense Intelligence Agency report on Gitmo detainees who had been released and have returned to terrorist activity. This got reported in broad generalities. 61 was the figure that was used by Jeff Morrell, Gates' press secretary, about what the findings of the report were. And immediately after that, and then there was a lot of back and forth. You probably watched maybe some of the cable talk shows on this, in which people were picking apart the methodology used by DIA? How did they know this? Where did they get the information from? How did they really know who these people were? And did they really return to the battlefield? Or were they just suspected of returning to the battlefield? What's the evidence to back it up? And I, like others, said, okay, let's see the report. I'd like to see this report. And I was told it was going to be forthcoming fairly soon, that previous reports along these lines, which had shown much lower figures, had been declassified and released. This one was going through the process, and I reported, I think, on February 5th, that the DIA report would be released within the next week or so, because I was told by two sources at the Pentagon that that was the expectation. Well, here we are, March 16th, there is no report from the DIA that has been released, although it was supposed to have been released 6 weeks ago. Expectation. I went back to the sources who had told me it was about to be released and said, well, it's sitting in detainee affairs. We're not really sure when it's going to be released. There are some people who are not so happy about this being released. And look, I mean, you know, the Obama people didn't do the report. It was done by DIA. But it clearly is not helpful if one of your foreign policy goals is to shut down Gitmo. It's the kind of report that would give fodder to the critics who say it's too dangerous to let these people go. We need to have some sort of more orderly way of reviewing who these people are. And there's no question at all that the first time a Gitmo detainee who was released under Obama's watch as opposed to Bush's watch, returns to terrorist activity, is found in Afghanistan or found in Yemen, it is going to be a huge political firestorm, and the Republicans will have a field day with it, and the Obama people know it. So this is the last thing they want you all, us all, to be writing about, to be thinking about. So it's really not surprising that they're sitting on this report that was supposed to have been cleared for release 6 weeks ago. But that said, going back to what I was saying before, it's easy to release stuff that makes your predecessor look bad. It's a lot tougher when it's going to complicate your own, when it either makes you look bad or complicate your own decision-making and your own policy agenda. And I have to say, if we're really committed to transparency and openness as opposed to promoting a particular political agenda, you got to hold their feet to the fire on this. If the goal is transparency, then we got to see that Gitmo report that they're sitting on and who's returned to the battlefield. And we can debate it openly and see how good a report is it, how solid it is without seeing it. We don't know. Just a couple of other quick observations. I don't want to ramble on here. Just as a reporter, having covered previous White Houses, covering this one, I'd love to tell you my experiences are night and day. They're not. It's dark and dark. These guys will, you know, they're pleasant because I know some of them from the campaign. I've known some of them for years socially. But when you ask them tough questions, when you suggest you're writing a story that might not be the kind of thing that they're interested in putting out there, they're no more open. They're no more happier to engage than previous administrations. I got to say, I've had a couple of experiences now on foreign policy issues, you know, or national security related issues, where I've posed questions to them very often by email, and don't get any responses at all. Now, maybe they just don't like me. I don't know. You can never rule out that possibility. But generally under the Bush era, I would pose email questions. I remember I have a whole stack of emails from Leon McBride, who was Cheney's press secretary for the last 4 or 5 years, and invariably she would get back to you and say, hi, Mike, sorry, we can't help you today. We got nothing to say on this. Have a nice day. And I kind of liked it. She was always very smiley face, have a nice day. The only difference here under the Obama people is that I'm starting, I don't want to say it's a pattern yet, but I've had three or four experiences where I don't get anything back, you know, not even the have a nice day. So, you know, we'll make of that what you will. And finally, look. In terms of seeing this, seeing government material, at least the kind of material that I've been writing about over the last, certainly since 9/11 on a regular basis, which is very often intertwined with classification. You know, it's all classified. Look at the big issues of the Bush era. You know, the today's front page story about that stunning International Red Cross report on documenting, or at least from the perspective of the high-value detainees, what was done to them, the waterboarding, the brutal beatings, you know, that which the Red Cross termed to be torture and found consistency in those 14 statements from those 14 high-value detainees describing very similar treatment and what went on to them. We, to this day, and Patrick Leahy could have told you this, you know, the big proponent of the Truth Commission, we have no authoritative account of exactly what was done, of what kind of intelligence it produced. All we have are, on the one hand, the claims of Dick Cheney saying this stuff was absolutely essential to helping us thwart terrorist attacks. Which terrorist attacks, we can't tell you. It's all classified. And then the claims of human rights groups that say, these guys were tortured, and I was particularly struck by the, not in the New York Times version of this, but if you go to the New York Review of Books version, the longer version by Mark Danner, who got the report, the quote from colleague Sheikh Mohammed, who told the, let's see, I may actually even have it here, who told the Red Cross the following, and for some reason this wasn't in the New York Times version. Quote, I gave a lot of false information in order to satisfy what I believe the interrogators wished to hear in order to make the ill treatment stop. I'm sure that the false information I was forced to invent wasted a lot of their time and led to several false red alerts being placed in the United States. Great. Is that what these aggressive techniques, waterboarding and others, gave to us? I don't know. I have yet to see an authoritative account one way or the other. I'd love to know. I think it's essential to evaluating Bush-era policies on the war on terror. We have yet to see it because it all remains classified. And the push for declassification is, in my mind, the most important single thing. That gets beyond a FOIA request is not going to do it. Even a congressional subpoena is not going to do it. There has to be a better and more effective institutional structure to get material declassified, and until we can, and I know there's people from the Public Interest Declassification Board here tonight, might be able to talk about this, but in my mind, that is the single biggest hurdle, the single biggest obstacle to true transparency and openness in government. And on that note, I'll let my colleagues here weigh in.
Thank you. By the way, because it is getting late in the day and some of you have been sitting for a long time, we're going to kind of, I want to give you a challenge for the end of this afternoon. For each of our speakers, I want you to come up with a popular song title. It occurred to me after hearing Mike's opening that you can't always get what you want. Probably is the one that ought to apply, and I haven't yet, we'll have to listen to the other speakers, but please, we'll collect some of these at the end for our listening pleasure. David?
Thanks, Tom. I have to say that this speaking on this panel was kind of a difficult assignment for a few reasons. I mean, first of all, as Mike said, it's only been 7 weeks, so it's very early, and there's not, you wouldn't think, a lot to talk about. So, I mean, it is difficult to make an assessment. The other reason why it's difficult is that I really would like to be as supportive as possible of the new administration, because as you all know, on day one, the president really, you know, took an unprecedented action in issuing the various transparency directives that were issued, which I believe you know about and were part of the materials for the conference. So I won't go into them in detail. So not for partisan reasons, but just because of that early commitment to transparency, I really do want to be as supportive of this administration as possible. But on the other hand, I do think that in the course of the last 7 weeks, there have been a few indications that probably would be fair to characterize as mixed messages. So I just want to kind of go through those quickly, really more just, you know, in terms of stating facts and, you know, sharing with you the sense of not really understanding yet where things seem to be going. So there were the January 21st declarations, one of which, the most specific memorandum that dealt with FOIA, among other things, directed the Attorney General to implement new guidelines for FOIA compliance within the federal government. I'm going to come back to that in a minute because it relates to the main point that I'm going to be discussing. So obviously, the open government community was very pleased to see that. We had all, as organizations who work on this issue collectively, weighed in with the administration on a number of suggestions, several of which were spearheaded by Tom's organization, the National Security Archive. And, you know, we were frankly flabbergasted on the president's first full day in office to see that many of the things that we as public interest groups interested in these issues had recommended were actually happening. So that obviously was, you know, a very positive starting point. Also on the positive side, as Mike mentioned, some of the OLC memos have been released. There are obviously more, and probably the more difficult ones that remain to be addressed. There was the reversal of the policy dealing with news coverage and photography at Dover Air Force Base of caskets returning from Iraq. That was another positive development in terms of opening up previously closed government activities from public view. So obviously there have been some good steps in this short period of time. But I want to speak now about the specific experiences I've had as someone who is litigating pending Freedom of Information cases that originated during the Bush administration and have now been part of the transition, meaning that they obviously are still pending and decisions now need to be made within the government in terms of the disposition of these pending cases. I'll mention just three of them to give you a sense of the kinds of subject matter that my organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, tends to seek and tends to litigate over. One of these pending cases is against the Department of Homeland Security for information on a program called the Automated Targeting System, which is something that Customs and Border Patrol uses when people come in and out of the country. It actually assigns a risk score to everyone, both citizen and non-citizen, who crosses the border. So obviously there are significant privacy issues that arise as a result of the use of this system and the collection of the information that drives the system. One of our pending FOIA cases seeks information about that ATS system. Another one is a case against the FBI for information on a system called the Investigative Data Warehouse, which is a huge data mining system that contains billions of records containing personal information on presumably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of citizens. And then another case that is pending is against the Department of Justice and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence seeking information concerning lobbying efforts by telecommunications companies in the context of the legislation that was enacted that granted immunity to the telecom companies for their participation in the warrantless wiretapping program. So those are three of the pending cases we have. So when the president issued his directive on January 21st and directed the attorney general, who was not yet in office at that time, to implement new guidelines on FOIA implementation, we thought it was reasonable to go to the Justice Department lawyers who were opposing in these cases and suggest that further proceedings in the cases be delayed or stayed until the Attorney General's new guidelines were issued. In other words, give the new administration an opportunity to look at the material that's at issue in these cases and make a determination as to whether or not, in light of the new Attorney General guidelines, there's some reason for them to rethink what's being withheld and, you know, talk about where the case stands. The Justice Department uniformly, in those cases that I mentioned, opposed our suggestion. We, as a result, needed to file motions with the courts where the cases are pending, asking for stays, and in all of those cases, the Justice Department is aggressively opposing our motions to stay those cases. So that's one data point in terms of the position that the new administration is taking. And, you know, what's frustrating about that example is we're not asking them now, 7 weeks after coming into office, to make substantive decisions rolling back any decisions that had been made by the Bush administration. We're just asking them to agree to hold off on making those decisions and in making litigation decisions until there is time for the new policy to be implemented. But that request, as I say, has been opposed. Now, you could say that the position in those cases might be a result of the fact that the new leadership of the Justice Department has not fully taken charge. The number two and three officials just took office last week. So, you know, that's a plausible explanation of why we've had the experience we've had. But my next example is a little bit closer to home in terms of the White House and really gives me even more pause than the position in those three lawsuits that I mentioned. In the early days of the administration, meaning the first couple of weeks, there were two technology issues that arose within the White House, which my organization is an organization that's interested in technology and privacy issues, wanted to pursue. The first was the fact that the White House website, whitehouse.gov, was generating cookies when any video material was accessed on the White House. This was as a result of the third-party provider for that video footage being YouTube, and YouTube generates cookies which allow the tracking of users. Now, this was in violation of federal policy that goes back a few years. There was an OMB directive issued a few years ago that prohibited the generation of cookies by federal websites. So the White House privacy policy needed to make the notation that cookies are being generated by YouTube when you access material at whitehouse.gov, and this is the result of an exemption which has been granted by the White House Counsel's Office. Well, we thought it was only reasonable to write to Mr. Craig, the White House Counsel, to ask him to explain the basis for the grant of that waiver. Now, obviously, the White House Counsel's Office is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. We noted that in our letter, but we also said that in light of the President's stated objective of being the most transparent administration in history, we were asking as a matter of discretion that information concerning the grant of that waiver be made public. It's been 6 weeks. We have not received any response to our letter to Mr. Craig, even after a follow-up letter reminding him
that we had made the request for a discretionary release of the information. The other example had to do with the president's use of his so-called BlackBerry, which apparently is not a BlackBerry, but it's colloquially referred to as his BlackBerry. And there were some very interesting Presidential Records Act issues that arose concerning the president's use of this device. So we thought it was appropriate to inquire about what, if any, policies or procedures had been mandated governing the use of BlackBerry-type devices by the president and other senior officials to ensure compliance with the Presidential Records Act. That request we directed to the White House Office of Administration, which basically, as its name implies, handles a variety of administrative chores for the White House. Now, the interesting wrinkle here is that the Office of Administration, up until the Bush 43 administration, had considered itself subject to the Freedom of Information Act and had readily complied with FOIA requests. The Bush administration changed that policy. Its refusal to honor FOIA requests was subsequently upheld by Judge Kolar Catelli in District Court in Washington, and that question is now pending on appeal before the D.C. Circuit. But again, we thought that for an administration that on day one had said it was committed to an unprecedented level of transparency, that it seemed like it was a no-brainer for them to immediately in their first few weeks in office say, okay, we're going to go back to the practice that was in place before Bush and honor FOIA requests to the Office of Administration. Again, that request has now been pending for 6 or 7 weeks with no response. So those are examples that I don't think we can just write off to the Justice Department not yet fully having its act together. These requests went to Mr. Craig on the one hand and directly to the Office of Administration on the other. And you would think, as I said, that an administration that was really committed to what the president said on January 21st, those were requests that should have been, at the very least, responded to. So let me just close by saying that while what the president did on his first day in office was obviously promising and positive, there comes a point, and I'm not sure if we're there yet, but I think we're getting close, where you have to ask whether the reality matches the rhetoric. And that's a matter of, you know, the culture within bureaucracies and really making hard decisions that result in the actual release of information and not merely, you know, window dressing of presidential memos and attorney general guidelines. And in the instances in which I've cited, we have tried aggressively to push for those kinds of decisions, and thus far the results are not completely in line with the rhetoric. Let me leave it at that point, and Tom also has some the National Security Archive also has some litigation that appears to be in limbo, so Tom might want to make some reference to that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, David. Dan Metcalf, we should thank Dan for giving us the absolute worst place in a conference, which is standing between you and an open bar. And so here we are, taking our lives in our hands.
I figure if anybody can handle it, you can.
Oh, now he's going to make it a cash bar, so just to keep us safe. No, every time I'm asked to deliver a judgment like we're asked on this panel today, I'm reminded of the Bible verse, let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone. And lo and behold, from my sinful perspective, I decided to look for other metaphors than the casting of stone. And I was thinking more like maybe what we've got here is really a parent-teacher conference, you know, 7 weeks into the new school, the kids, how are they settling in, how are they doing, what happened on those first tests, getting their homework done, how's it look? And I came up with a kind of a top 10 list, sort of the David Letterman approach to keeping you awake at 4:45 in the afternoon. And on the top 10 list, and it's going to repeat a little bit of what you've already heard, obviously number one is day one, flying colors, A+.
Compared to the first day of the Bush administration, when the first action of the White House counsel was to stuff 60,000 pages of Reagan Library documents that had already been cleared for release back into the vault, where they stayed for almost a couple of years until they had time to revise the Presidential Record Act through executive order. So this day one was entirely different, and that's an A+. The kids are settling in fine, adjusting to their new digs. I'd say the second piece of it, and you've heard a little bit of this mentioned today, is the test of the secret law. And those are the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel memos, and a partial release there, a good start. But as Michael says, the really tough ones they haven't faced up to yet. But still, it was a good signal, and the remarks by Don Johnson and others about how they're going to treat OLC memos, how they're going to make sure there's not such a thing as a secret law, how Congress really deserves to see those in some format or another. There should no longer be a safe in the Vice President's office, which is the only container of the legal standards our government's supposed to follow. So good start, but incomplete. In the category of terrible start, but staying after school to do some makeup, is our piece of litigation on the White House email. A terrible start because on that first day, when you get the clarion call from the president, that simultaneously in federal court, the Justice Department is filing a really nasty dismissal motion, arguing that we got no standing, there's no basis, and they've already recovered the emails, but they have nothing on the record to show what they've done. Millions are still potentially missing. So that was the day one, and I basically take that filing as a kind of a sucker punch by the Department of Justice on the new Obama people, but they're responsible for it. Somebody in the transition process looked at that filing and agreed to it. So that was a terrible start, a flunking grade on their first day of dealing with litigation, and yet now there's been a lot of reaching out, and I think the Obama White House counsel's office may actually be sending David a smiley face pretty soon because they reached out to us and sent us a smiley face, and now there's some discussions about how you're going to work out the White House email to actually preserve the current email and make sure that the Bush email is recovered. And that's incomplete, but good after-school makeup homework working. The really incomplete, as David said, was the overall freedom of information litigation and really the inertia of the legal bureaucracy, the government, just to not take a look at those pending cases. And when we actually see the revisiting of those standards and this the end of this reflexive opposition that folks got into over the last 8 years, when really, as freedom of information litigators, we're trying to do the right thing, too. It's not in our interest to tie down and burden government. We want to see that more active disclosure, and it's actually in the interest of the government. But there, and that's a fourth test, it's really incomplete. First signal's not so hot. And finally, the fifth test that the kids have actually taken already in these first 7 weeks of school, the fifth test, they flunked altogether, and that was the state secrets litigation. I mean, when you've got a government attorney going up before the Ninth Circuit and saying, you know, we're going to stick to what we said in that last filing, and you have a judge on the panel look down at him and says, really? Really? Somehow I thought the president was elected on a different platform than that. When you have the judge on the appeals court querying the Justice Department about their claim, you got to see that as a wake-up call. This is a terrible place. And so how are the Obama people possibly going to recover from that flunking grade? Well, they could embrace the current legislation in Congress that would actually give judges the tools and the authority to look behind government secrecy claims in these cases. And that's what they ought to do because they're off to a terrible start there. The next five tests that the kids are going to have to take in these next few months and the things we really need to look for and watch their grades and make sure they're doing okay, maybe make them go to bed a little bit earlier if they turn up with problems. Number one has got to be that Attorney General's memo that's just a couple of months away. Will it just be a return to the Janet Reno standards, or will it be forward to Facebook FOIA, you know, where stuff just goes up there onto the web proactively, that any FOIA request that's not a privacy request, just the results get posted on the web? I mean, what is the AG going to do? And how effective will that memo actually be? I remember the audit that the National Security Archive did of the Ashcroft memo, the infamous Ashcroft memo, sent around freedom of information requests to all these agencies. What did you do to change your procedures in response to this directive from Attorney General Ashcroft? And we had three or four agencies sort of called us back and said, excuse me, what memo was that? And could you send us a copy? We never really got that word. You get a sense of the diversity out there that even if they do turn the wheel, the rudder may not be connected to the wheel sometimes. But that's first test coming up, the Attorney General's memo. How proactive will it be? Second test will be the open government implementation of the president's goal of a truly proactive open government. What will the General Services Administration and the Office of Management and Budget and the Chief Technology Officer come up with for the new frontier? How will they reduce the burden of processing Freedom of Information requests by making this stuff far more actively available, proactively available? Will they follow the model of some of the best practices out there, like NASA, putting up all the results of the Challenger investigations and seeing a big drop in their incoming FOIA requests, because you can point to it on the web. There it is. Efficiency for government, efficiency for the public. That's where we've got to find those pieces that work. The third big test, I think, after the Attorney General's memo and the Open Government Directive is going to be personnel. Who are they going to hire? Who's going to be the archivist? Is it going to be just another archivist, or is it going to be a transformational person, somebody who's going to look at the records of the federal government and say, you know, my job is to make sure all these people obey the law? I heard Jason say, well, we're not a police force. Well, the National Archives has a ton of tools. It's just that we and outsiders have ended up using them to force action, whether it's recovering the Kissinger documents they took away to the Library of Congress or trying to preserve the White House email. I mean, it's an astounding state of affairs when the National Archives finds out that the White House hasn't implemented an email archiving system when an independent counsel makes a filing in a court case involving Scooter Libby to reveal that whole days are missing. That's how the National Archives found out. It's extraordinary. So who's the archivist? At a lower level, who's going to head that ombuds office that's now been put in place by the Open Government Act of 2007? Will it just be someone from inside, or is it going to be somebody who really understands that you can make a difference, you can lay down principles, you can take exemplary cases of Freedom of Information disputes that involve thousands of requesters or major principals where there really is controversy, and settle them? Come to a decision and make sure everybody knows it. Drive the process down into the agencies by truly intervening and being the kind of ombudsperson that can make the system work. A fourth great test, and this we heard a lot about in the previous panel, electronic records. White House has to lead by putting in place a serious email archiving system, but the White House has to lead by doing more than that. I mean, according to OMB's own data, the government spends $68 billion on information technology, contracts, services, hardware, software. That money has to be spent with front-end requirements for archiving and back-end requirements for preservation and access. And without that, we're always going to be catching up, as the National Archives is doing today, to the e-records world. We're losing history every day. Every day a unit moves out of Iraq and pulls its hard drives and washes them because they got to clean them for security reasons. You're losing the PowerPoints that drove the decision-making and the operations on the ground unless somebody from the Army Lessons Learned Center or the Air Force History Office is looking over their shoulder, making a copy of that hard drive. Some of that history is gone forever. Or the video teleconferencing, which is how high-level decisions are made today in the classified world. Who's saving those? The reality is digital storage is incredibly cheap. It doesn't cost us a lot to save it all, but we're not going to have it down the road unless we intervene and save it now. And the final, I think, great test for the kids is going to be the classification universe, declassification. Not only the specific examples that Mike talked about, we do need, as Tom Sussman has said in one of his recent talks, not so much a truth commission as a sunshine commission. Open up the records of the last 8 years so we can get at some of the questions as Michael poses them. We also need to address that huge mountain of classified records that the most recent Public Interest Declass Board report outlined in such dramatic terms. True crises, a tsunami, a landslide that's going to bury us unless we can figure our way out. Resources are a core issue, and this is what Herb Brick was asking about. The government spends $10 billion a year on its classification, security, information management, Tempest, and the other procedures that are involved in this, and that's the reported number. There's also a classified number that probably throws a few more billion dollars into the pot. If you just ordered them 5% of that, tell every agency that creates a secret, you have a 5% sales tax on your classification decision. You stamp something secret, it's going to cost you. You got to put it into the pot for declassification. That amount of money would more than double the total budget of the National Archives. 5% of the total classification system costs would throw $500 million into creating a National Declassification Center, into creating a serious process to address that mountain of secrets, into creating preserving history on the front end and making more access on the back end. There are a lot of out-of-the-box ideas, I think, that we need also to take a look at. But I would say those are our tests to begin with. Flying colors on day one, bad start, but some makeup tests on the White House email, really incomplete on addressing FOIA litigation, secret law, good start, but also similarly incomplete. Terrible on state secrets, flunking grade. But then these next five tests, let's hold their feet to the fire. We've got a great opportunity here. I actually am quite optimistic, and not least because there's wine and beer waiting for us outside. Thank you.
But even with that, you will have time, if you want, to ask questions. I'm going to certainly ask at least one or two. And one of them is initiated by David's observations about what's going on in the courtroom that is doesn't seem to be synchronized with what's going on in the policy rooms. Back in the Carter administration, I believe, the Attorney General put out a memorandum directing his litigators to examine outstanding Freedom of Information cases to see which ones, I got to look over and make sure Dan keeps nodding, to see which ones could be disposed of under the sort of new day of, you know, Carter openness as opposed to Nixon Ford secrecy. And my recollection is that little or nothing came of that. Do you have, other than just saying, give us the documents, do you have any sort of systemic suggestions? Maybe that would work, again, if there was continuity within the Justice Department to follow through and look at the outstanding cases, because there are a lot of them. I mean, you mentioned a few. I certainly have been involved in a couple myself that I'd love to see some settlement discussions as opposed to continuing the litigation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say I'm not optimistic. You go back a little further than I do, so you can talk about Carter administration examples, but I sort of, you know, pick it up with the transition from Reagan into Clinton. So, you know, there's always a lot of talk about the Reno memo, which was undone by the Ashcroft memo, and the assumption is that, you know, because of the Reno memo, the Clinton administration was this golden age of transparency. Now, it's important to understand what the Reno memo said and what was then undone by the Ashcroft memo. For my purposes, what was important about those two things is it had to do with the standard that the Justice Department would apply to deciding whether or not it was going to defend an agency's decision to withhold information. So you would think that when the Reno memo comes out, and there are pending cases, that I would get calls from Justice Department lawyers saying, you know, under the new standard of the Reno memo, we've taken a look at this case, and we're going to be releasing the information, and we'd like you to dismiss the case. It never happened. So, you know, based on that experience, I'm a little bit apprehensive in concluding that, you know, the anticipated rollback of the Ashcroft memo is going to have a real impact. So, you know, that's why I say that it's got to be more than just, you know, the rhetoric and the directives. There has to be some way to really get into the culture of, first of all, the people and agencies who make FOIA decisions, and then the frontline litigators in the Justice Department, or else it's just, you know, a platitude in an Attorney General's memo or a presidential memo.
Mike and Tom, do you have any suggestions about the cultural issue? I mean, I think a lot of the problems go to that culture that exists, that as you talk about turning the ship and not attached to the rudder, or the rhetoric of the president and the head of the agency not being followed by the staff. I mean, I've heard that referred to for decades now about the culture of the bureaucracy remaining unmoved by the rhetoric of the politicians. What can we do about that?
Not that much, really. I mean, I think there's a certain culture of secrecy that every White House that I have ever encountered, every administration has. It's sort of basic Darwinian. You're there to preserve and perpetuate yourself and the people of your political party. So you are going to act in ways that are going to promote them and not. But, big, important releases of information always come about as a result of political forces that get beyond, that go beyond what an administration can control. And I should point out that for all the secrecy of the Bush administration, you had two institutional pushes that produced actually a fair amount of information, much of it classified, that was produced because the political forces were there. Number one, the Senate Intelligence Committee, which normally releases nothing, did a report in 2004 on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and how the intelligence agencies got it so wrong. And if you go back and look at it, it is a goldmine of declassified information about what went on within the CIA, within the intelligence community, to produce the NIE prior to the run-up to the Iraq War, and all the other claims made by during the Bush administration run-up. Now, why was that produced? Because the intelligence community, and more importantly, the Senate Intelligence Committee itself, had egg all over its face. They were all embarrassed, and they had to explain how they, as well as the administration and the CIA, got it all wrong. And there had to be some public accounting because of the colossal misstatements that were made during the run-up to the Iraq War. So that was number one. And number two, the 9/11 Commission. You go back and read it, and particularly the footnotes, there is an enormous amount of information about U.S. counterterrorism operations and policies during both the Clinton and the Bush era that would normally never get produced. Why? Because you had the question of political accountability. You had the families, the 9/11 families that had been demanding some accountability. You had forces in Congress that were pushing for accountability, and as a result, there became a political imperative to explain how we were able to get attacked on 9/11 and 3,000 of our citizens were killed, and the intelligence community was unable to foresee that. So in both instances, when you have political forces at work that an administration can't control, you can get enormous amounts of information released. I think you can go back to, church committees, similar sort of experiences in the past. But absent those, do I really think you're going to get fundamental change? The answer, in short, is no.
There's an optimist. Tom, do you want to add anything now, or shall we? Okay, let's go straight. Dick?
I wanted to just touch on two points that you and David mentioned. While I was at the Department of Justice
I was looking over there while I was
with Dan, the two of us working together and sometimes against each other for 25 years, it was our experience that during the following the Reno memo, when she also picked up that same point of Griffin Bell's about reviewing litigation, there were a number of cases. I think you were terribly unfortunate, or statistically a small sample that just didn't hit your cases. We had one case that the government had won at the Court of Appeals dealing with Kurt Waldheim, and the case had already been won. And that was included in a review, and I don't want to say every word, but the huge share of what had been withheld had all been then disclosed as a result exclusively of her discretionary disclosure review. So I think in many cases that does make a difference. That's one of the things that also I think can help turn the ship around a little bit is not only the president talking about that with his memo, but if Holder's memo is a good, solid one, and then if he goes out there and starts talking to the troops. Reno, not too long after her memo, it was not immediately, but she ended up going to talk to 450 Freedom of Information Act officers at one of our conferences, and, you know, she shook her fist for a little while and told them it's important to get information out and pay attention to whether or not harm's going to be caused and so on and so forth. And that's the sort of thing that makes it a little easier for these people to carry that back and talk to their program people or to talk to their boss and say, this is what the Department of Justice says we're supposed to be doing. It's just as David says, the only real hammer the Department of Justice has is we won't defend you in litigation, the legal hammer. But the amount of information and credence that can be carried the other way certainly can make it. My final observation is when we talk about thinking about the Freedom of Information Act, here's all of the documents. We're going to disclose all of these every time. And we're going to withhold all of these every time. We're just really working in here. I mean, these are the ones where, you know, we're never going to give out the names of our confidential informants, and we're always going to give out this stuff here. And it may very well be that Tom would say, it's not like this. And Tom, it depends on what agency you're with in terms of something like that. But that's what I've got. Yeah.
Good,
well,
thanks.
Dick, all I can say in response to that is, you know, I'm kind of hearing for the first time about these real-world results of the Reno memo, and I mean, I think what it indicates is... I think the point is it was probably such a small number that there wasn't this sense that rippled through the FOIA litigation community that, wow, there's really this sea change. Because, I mean, other people in the room in the community might have a different recollection, but, you know, I don't remember that sense sort of going out to requesters, and I suspect it also didn't go out to FOIA officers and agencies, and I think that's what needs to happen.
Wouldn't have gone out to FOIA officers. That part was senior people in the civil division, senior people in the tax division at the Department of Justice that were reviewing all of the cases that Justice had control over to see whether or not we could. And, of course, there weren't many where we disclosed everything, but there were a number where we disclosed a hunk more information than we had. And I don't want to make it sound like it was 50%, but there was significantly more information being disclosed than had previously in litigation. And I certainly hope that would be a part of Eric Holder's.
Oh, I would agree. I mean,
I think we would agree.
It's a visible impact. It is going to ripple through the community, yeah. But I don't think the wake of the Reno memo did that. That's my point.
Yeah, I mean that is an important point because if the line officers don't see the possibility that the Justice Department is going to make them give the information up despite their inclination to withhold, if that information doesn't get from the litigators back to the agencies, then the next time around there's no changed incentive.
Tom, not to interrupt Dick, but I've done it so many times over the years, I'll do it anyway. You're confusing two things. It's one thing if David didn't learn about it, but in fact all the FOIA officers did learn about it without any question. It's unfortunate that David didn't notice it, but the agency people did because we told them directly.
That doesn't square with what Tom Blanton said about the response to the archives question about the Ashcroft memo. I mean, it seems like there's this...
Maybe they just don't read FOIA update then.
No. Here's how it does. We implemented the hell out of the Reno memo. We didn't do that for the Ashcroft memo. So believe me, what I'm telling you is reality.
Okay.
Whether you perceived it or were aware of it or not is another thing. But with respect to the point officers getting the message, reality is they did. And the whole point is that ought to happen again.
I think the song representing this last exchange might be Magical Mystery Tour. Yes, sir.
Can I offer a song for Tom?
Sure.
How about Cry Me a River?
Yeah.
No, much happier. You need more upbeat. You know?
Good evening. My name's Ethan Marin. I'm a 3L here. And I don't want to keep us from the wine and beer any longer than necessary, but I just had a quick question. We've talked a lot in this panel about the policy changes that are going to come possibly in the Obama administration. And these are important and these are good. But the fact of the matter is, even the Bush administration, 9 times out of 10, probably did the right thing in response to their FOIA requests. There were some big doozies, but most of the time, even they got it right. The real problem, or at least I think the biggest problem, this is something, Mr. Isakov, you pointed out, is that it takes so darned long. I mean, just to pick an example, USCIS in DHS, you file a regular track FOIA request, and they tell you flat out, yeah, it'll take the better part of a year on average. And so what I'm curious about is, do you think that there are any prospects for the Obama administration putting in the additional resources to make the whole thing fast enough, or at least less slow, so it actually becomes more useful? And I welcome your thoughts.
Well, that's a start. Let's hope everyone enjoys the wine and beer.
Well, my quick thought is, given the constraints of the economic crisis right now, I don't know if additional FOIA resources will be considered stimulus spending or not, but I suspect
certainly
that
would stimulate this crowd.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with that. In fact, I, for years, have been kind of a broken record about resources, and I didn't mention it today, but I mean, it's clearly. Really, the biggest problem that I encounter as someone who attempts to use FOIA is just the interminable delays that you have to deal with before you get to the withholding decision, and then even have the ability to litigate the propriety of a withholding decision. I just think, something we in the FOIA requesting community always talk about is if you looked at the average agency's public relations budget generally, what they spend to put out the message they want to put out, and look at the percentage of that that goes into FOIA, which is the part of it where they're giving the information that the public is asking for, it's a very small percentage. And I personally would like to see something come out of the appropriations process that would tie those two numbers a little more closely together to say to an agency, if you're going to spend all this money promoting what you want to promote, you have to start devoting more of the resources to answering questions in terms of what the public wants to know about.
I would just add, too, I think that's exactly right. One, on the public relations budget. Second, I think you've got to draw a bright line across the old records, the historic records, set new standards for the release of anything more than 25 years old, or even, I think, in Germany or UK, they're talking about 15 years, or under the Presidential Records Act, it's 12 years for deliberative process material. So draw a bright line and treat that under very different standards with an independent review board that can push that out of the system so that Mike Bender of the Air Force, who just had to leave, is not sitting there reviewing 50-year-old documents today, which have a very limited effect on current national security when we could be processing the stuff out. So if you tied PR budgets, if you drew a bright line over the older records with a review board and a different standards like under the Nazi war crimes, and I think the third piece of the puzzle is the proactive disclosure by the agencies that looking for ways to put online everything that's coming out of their systems so you can refer requesters to that. So that, in effect, right now, the Freedom of Information Act or the leak are the two recourses for anybody who wants documents and information out of the government that is mildly sensitive.
We have to make the Freedom of Information request be the exception, not the rule. It should only be reserved for their cases where there really is a contest of interest that need to be adjudicated by some independent party, but that the normal way that people get information should be by going to a website and searching it. And that's the question of whether the holder memo or the long-term or the disclosure memo are going to take us closer to that place so that the Freedom of Information Act is reserved just for the hard cases. Anyway. But I would just say in final conclusion, we should all have a little humility 7 weeks in. I still remember, I think it was Zhou Enlai talking with Henry Kissinger, and Kissinger said, so what did you think about the French Revolution and its long-term its impact? And Zhou Enlai said, I think it's too soon to tell.
Dan wanted to ask the last question, but I remind him of the Elvis Presley song, Don't Be Cruel.
Ooh. Ooh. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. No, no, no. Steelers Wheels, 1975. Just one quick question going down the list, and Tom just alluded to it in what he spoke a moment ago. Beyond the change of the legal standard and beyond perhaps proactive disclosure, is there any other element that you would like to see in the holder memorandum based upon the premise that your articulation of it now could have some impact and that it's not going to be issued tomorrow or the next day, in other words, during Sunshine Week? Is there anything else that you would like to see in the holder memorandum?
I don't know if the holder memorandum is the vehicle for it, but I just want to come back to the point I made about declassification. There's got to be some institutional mechanism to force declassification. Everybody agrees there's too much over-classification. Everybody who's ever looked at the issue says far too much is classified, yet nobody has figured out a vehicle to force agencies to declassify documents. I don't know if the holder memorandum is the vehicle to do that.
Maybe not.
But something that gives the Public Interest Declassification Board real teeth, or some other alternative way of forcing it. That's the most significant thing.
David, if I gave you an artificial choice, which is not entirely fair perhaps, you be the judge, between having the holder memorandum talk about the type of litigation review we were discussing or backlog reduction, which would you say is more important, or would you say both?
I'd be selfless and say and recognize that the vast majority of requesters are not involved in litigation, so what would have the biggest impact would be an across-the-board attempt to reduce backlogs. I'm not sure the Attorney General has the wherewithal or the jurisdiction to do that, but if I had to choose one, I would say it would be that. But let me just add, in talking about the guidelines or the memo or whatever we want to call it, I'll pass along a suggestion that our friend Harry Hammett made when he and I were talking about this earlier, which is that it would be very nice if we weren't left to the whims of different administrations with respect to some of these policy decisions. It would be nice if Congress, perhaps at the suggestion or request of the Obama administration, would actually legislate on things like presumptions and some of the things that have been left to these changing Attorney General memos.
So it would be codified with permanence.
That would be nice.
How about you, Tom?
Classic example of that is the Leahy language to overturn the Ashcroft memo got slid up into the preamble where it had no legal weight.
This is in the 1996 amendments.
Exactly. That
was more recently, but that also had to do with the 96 amendments on Reporters Committee,
which
will be the subject of our program on April 28th, as a matter of fact.
I would just say the one piece in terms, I don't think the holder memo is going to do everything. I would want it to review litigation. I would want it to address backlogs. One of the results of our government-wide audits that Kristen Adair and many others of the National Security Archive folks have found is that it's a different circumstance in almost every different agency. There are different reasons why the system is broken. Some places it's just not leadership. Resources. Some places they're drowning in resources. They just have created a deliberately inefficient system. And you almost need a case-by-case assessment of the individual agencies to get at the backlog problem. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution.
So if you were Attorney General Holder and had that perspective that you just articulated, would you in your memorandum speak to the heads of other agencies directly and strongly urge them to undertake the type of review you're talking about?
Exactly, and I would tell the Office of Personnel Management to relook at its letter to, wonderfully, it was addressed to Dick Cheney in December, and it said the Office of Personnel Management can't do anything to change the classification or the way that people in the federal government are rewarded based on their freedom of information performance.
The job series.
Ducking of the entire issue that the Open Government Act tried to get OPM just to look at, how do you change the incentive structure within the culture of secrecy so people are rewarded for being responsive under the Freedom of Information Act? How do you change the incentive structure in the culture of secrecy to prevent that initial classification action or push as much information above the tear line, as Scott and others were saying, as you can in order to reduce the long-term costs? Those are the challenges.
Tom, final suggestion, yeah. Either a holder memorandum element or another song title could go either way or maybe both.
No, I think the holder could certainly request, if not direct agencies, to look at and report on databases. It seems to me in this electronic era, more and more information is being maintained in their own independent, autonomous databases. And then when a Freedom of Information Act request comes in, it's put in line and treated like a request for paper out of a file. If the agency in advance took steps to aggregate, segregate, make publicly available without Freedom of Information requests, information that they have electronically stored in their databases, I think then we could cut down a lot of the individual requests and we wouldn't need any more resources.
That's a terrific idea. Let me just suggest that that's something could even find its way into the other process of the other day one memorandum regarding transparency and open government once there's a new chief technology officer appointed, who could take that sort of idea and work it in there as part of a new openness and government initiative, even if it's maybe too late. If, for example, hypothetically, the Holder Memorandum were to be issued, oh, I don't know, sometime this week, perhaps, it would still be an opportunity to work it into that as well. Listen, one thing we have seen here, folks, not just on this panel, but largely so in comparison to the others as well, is that this issue is one that brings out a lot of passion. And you've been able to see it right here on this panel, and we've been able to see it all day. And part of that, a big part of that, is the passion that you bring and the enthusiasm that you bring in coming to a program like this. So while we thank this panel, I also thank you for your kind attendance. And, yes, there is beer and wine in the lobby.